From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette, and you're listening to Idaho Matters. In October of last year, the FDA announced a shortage of Adderall due to manufacturing delays. Well, here we are, 6 months later, and it is now a severe shortage of not just Adderall, but similar drugs that treat ADHD, and it is wreaking havoc on the lives of children and adults who have this disease and need this medication. So what's going on and what can be done to fix this problem? Dr. David Pate, the former CEO of St. Luke's Health System, is joining us today to talk more about this, as well as other public health issues. And of course, he will answer your questions as well if you have anything you'd like to chat about in regards to public health. So send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Dr. Pate, it's nice to have you back.
Thank you, Gemma.
Okay, so can we go back to October when, as I mentioned, the FDA came out and said there's a shortage of Adderall, it's a manufacturing issue. So what is going on 6 months later?
Yeah, and this is really a different situation than what you and I have talked about before. When people were experiencing shortages of a lot of other medications. What has happened in this case is that the manufacturers of this medication projected how much they should make, and based on prior demands for the medication, and they planned for that. And what happened was over the course of the pandemic, the prescriptions for this drug have doubled, more than doubled, which is quite startling. What happens is that two complicating factors. One is the manufacturers couldn't increase their production that fast. And second, the ability for manufacturers to increase their production is limited by oversight from the DEA and FDA, because this is a controlled substance. And the problem being is that this drug has been subject to misuse and abuse. And so what has happened is the DEA carefully regulates and oversees how much medication is being produced and distributed and so forth, because they don't want it ending up in situations like what we had with the opiate crisis, that kind of thing. Problem is, that's put parents in a really tough spot for kids that, well, and some adults too need this, for those that need this. And I looked for the latest updates from the FDA. They are saying that some of these manufacturers are saying they should get caught up next month. Others are saying June, but it's been already, what, like 5 months or something. So it's been a huge problem for many people that, you know, as they're in school or work, it's just really a terrible problem to go without this medication. I think the FDA and the DEA need to do more in terms of changing how all the restrictions that we put on these drugs. Not that there shouldn't be restrictions, but we are making things too tough, in my mind. In some examples we can talk about if you're interested.
So can we? I do want to talk about this, because I think that people who do not need this drug, or they don't have a child that needs it, I think they don't understand, probably, because you don't need to understand all of the rules and restrictions around it. I certainly did not until my child, who has ADHD, needed this medication. And so first off, every state has different laws around these controlled substances. And I agree with you, Dr. Pate, that 100% we need rules and regulations around these medications. They are controlled substances. You don't want them to be overused. You don't want them to be abused. With that said, here in Idaho, you can only get a 30-day supply, and you can only refill that prescription, I believe, at the 28th day. So what we have run into in our family is that my child went almost a week without his medication. Our regular pharmacy still does not have this medication. I talked with the pharmacist, and what she recommended was call other pharmacies, see if they have it. But then you need to go get another prescription because we cannot exchange electronic prescriptions from pharmacy to pharmacy. So I am not the only person dealing with this. And at the same time, as you mentioned, I have a child in school who is doing his darndest to try to focus, to not try to have behavioral issues. And it is highly frustrating. So with all of that said, can we talk a little bit about these restrictions and if they potentially, in your mind, go too far or not?
Well, I think they do go a little bit too far. We do, as we both have said, this drug is very much subject to abuse, so we do have to have controls. You know, back in the day I was practicing, the only way you could get it filled is you actually had to come to my office and get a paper, what we called triplicate form. And it was highly burdensome for everyone. The good news now is that doctors can transmit this prescription electronically to the pharmacy. What it doesn't make sense to me, and certainly I think it would be good for the FDA and DEA to issue some statements about this, if it's safe enough for a doctor's office to transmit this electronically to the pharmacy, why is it not safe enough for a pharmacy to just transfer that prescription over to a different pharmacy? That makes no sense to me. And that is a huge burden, as you've just said. And Gemma, you're not the only person. I've been approached by many parents that are frustrated with this, trying to find solutions. The other thing, so I think that's one thing that needs to get addressed and relook at that rule. The other thing is, during this time, I don't know why the government can't set up a website much like they did for finding COVID vaccines, masks, COVID medications that were really good government sites where you could go and look to see, well, who's got this or that? And why don't they do that for these medications and their alternative medications so that people can know, instead of having to call every single pharmacy to find one, can know, you know, who's got it and who doesn't. I just think we need to be doing more to help these desperate parents. But I think even once this situation is remedied, I want the FDA and the DEA to reexamine this rule. If it's federal, now if it's our state, then I want the Idaho Department of Pharmacy to look at it. Why can't a pharmacy transfer one of these prescriptions to another pharmacy? It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, and Dr. Pate, how do you think misperceptions of ADHD play into this shortage of these controlled substances? Because it's not just Adderall. It really is the controlled substances that people use for ADHD. Because I think many people within our society believe that ADHD is a very mild condition. I mean, I even had the pharmacist when I was talking to her, and she meant very well, but she said, well, my best recommendation, as I said, is to call other pharmacies if he really needs the medication. And I did not have a filter. And I said, well, if he didn't need the medication, I would not be looking for it, but he needs it. And he can't.
Yeah, that pharmacist obviously did not know that you were the wrong person to say that to. You or my wife. Well, you know, the thing is, first of all, on one side, there is a lot of misunderstanding about just how disruptive ADHD can be. And like mm-hmm. you said, those parents that are blessed with children that don't have that problem, it may be hard to, and if they haven't had that problem, it may be understandable. It may be difficult to understand. Well, why can't a child just sit there? They just need to be disciplined or whatever, or,
right.
you know,
right.
they're just not listening. That's not it at all. You can talk to these kids all day long and it's not going to fix the problem. So part of it is not understanding that. The other part of the problem is that a lot of people have wanted these medications for things that are not ADHD. And right. while we've seen this big increase, like I said, more than doubling during the pandemic, no doubt part of it is when kids were staying home, parents were seeing this firsthand as they tried to help them with their schoolwork or get the schoolwork done and so forth. But the other thing is one has to wonder if, in fact, we know that quite commonly after COVID, kids and adults have difficulty concentrating and their thought processes can be disturbed for a while. And you wonder if there's a lot of people seeking out this medication for that problem, which is not ADHD. And some people just thinking, well, you know, it would just be helpful for me to have that. I'd perform at a higher level. So all of those things have to be put in this mix. But we do need to find solutions. And I do think that the FDA and the DEA need to communicate to parents better, explain what's going on, explain about alternatives, and try to ease these rules so that it is easier for that prescription to be transferred between pharmacies when it's sent to one that doesn't have it, but yet another one does.
Mm-hmm. And so bottom line, though, Dr. Payne, I mean, I've been told by pharmacists here in Idaho that we're going to see this shortage for the remainder of the year. And I think that has to go back to what you said with the FDA and the DEA, you know, deciding what the allocation is every year. So really, once again, this goes all the way back to the top where the FDA and DEA, as you said, really need to be re-looking at what they allocate, because if not, we're never going to get out of this shortage.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, I'm a little bit more optimistic than the pharmacists that you've talked to, although I acknowledge it's certainly a possibility that we may struggle mm-hmm. with this for some time. But I am encouraged that at least two manufacturers that I saw the updates for indicated they do expect to be able to address current demands, at least for their particular versions of the drugs, within the next couple of months. So we'll keep fingers crossed, but I nevertheless agree, FDA and DEA, let's communicate more. Let's talk about give parents some help, consider making that kind of a website that would allow them to be able to find these medications more easily. And let's relax some of the rules that really aren't making that much difference in preventing abuse. I'm not aware of a single case where a pharmacy transferring a prescription to another pharmacy resulted in somebody diverting medications. Maybe they are, and if so, you know, tell us. But it seems right. like what seems to be common today is legislators putting in rules or laws to address things that really aren't problems, and we need to stop doing that.
Well, and just for clarification, I should say I had a hard copy of a prescription, and I'm sure other parents went through this, took it to the pharmacy. They said, yes, we have it. Yes, we can fill it. However, we have to call your other pharmacy to cancel that electronic prescription. So, you know, you don't go and fill that one. Fair enough. Totally understand that. But I'm like, so you can cancel,
yes.
you can cancel, but you can't yeah. exchange it. Okay.
Yeah. So, this doesn't
all right.
make sense.
Let's move on because we do have some listener questions that we want to get to. So Mike wrote in and he asked, can you tell us about this new deadly fungus that's spreading through healthcare facilities that can kill people who are immunocompromised? What is it? And is it antibiotic resistant? And can healthy people be carriers? I have not heard about this, Dr. Pate.
Yes to all of the above. I first learned of this fungus in 2013 while I was CEO at St. Luke's. I saw the alert that we had our first case in the United States in a hospital in the Northeast, and I became concerned because I didn't know any reason why I would expect it to remain isolated there and that it wouldn't spread. So certainly during the time I was CEO, I asked to be updated if we ever identified a case at any of our St. Luke's hospitals and or facilities. And thank God, and I'm knocking on wood, as of the time I retired, we had not. This fungus actually goes back to, we can trace it as far back as 1996 in South Korea. It was first recognized in 2006, I think it was, in Japan, is where we became aware of it. And but as I said, it's been in the United States since 2013. It is, to answer this listener's question, it is fungus. For healthy people, it's not an issue. It may be on your skin somewhere, but what we say colonizing people, but that's not causing an infection. The problem is it is easily transmitted to other people, both by close contact with them or by surfaces if that it gets on. In fact, we have to use special disinfection procedures in the hospital, or the other place we can see these is like skilled nursing facilities, places where people are in for a while. The people that are really at risk for this infection are those that are immunocompromised, very sick, frequently in and out of healthcare facilities, have indwelling medical devices, those kinds of things. They are the ones that are at risk. And also to answer his question, yes, the concern is the our therapeutic options and increasing resistance. In 2021, this fungus tripled in the frequency with which it is resistant to antifungal drugs. We have three classes of antifungal drugs that we can use to treat these serious infections. And I should point out, a lot of people think about fungal infections like you get thrush in your mouth or you get vaginitis. We're talking here about a serious infection like it's in your bloodstream. It's making you very sick. And in those cases, we have three classes of drugs to look at. The tripling in resistance in the United States is to one of those classes. So we still have a couple other classes. However, the CDC recently issued an alert that there is worldwide a growing frequency of this fungus being now resistant to all three classes. So this is certainly a concern with respect to this fungus. I think antibiotic resistance in general is a huge concern that doesn't get very much attention, but can cause us problems for other things. I did check with the state of Idaho. We have, there is no requirement to report individual cases of this fungus called Candida auris, but there is a requirement to report outbreaks, and we've not had any outbreaks in Idaho so far. We'll hope we'll keep it that way, but I do think eventually we'll be dealing with this bug.
Okay. As always, Dr. Pate, thank you so much for your time and for your perspective on everything and educating us a little bit more. So just always appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jimma.
We've been talking with Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System. Remember, if you have questions in regards to anything about public health, send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudet. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is Chip Brantley, co-host of the NPR podcast White Lies. Before we found the man in Vancouver, before we sued the State Department, before we snuck into the graveyard of a federal penitentiary, all we had were the photographs. Photographs of a group of Cuban men standing on the roof of a prison in rural Alabama. That's this season on the NPR podcast, White Lies.